What I'm going to talk about is the area of the rights of prisoners. I'm a lawyer. I'm a constitutional lawyer. I deal with people's rights and liberties and trying to protect them such as they are, to expand them, to preserve them. And I want to talk to you about some of my problems in doing this and some of the problems that lawyers have and what we have accomplished, and I'm not sure that that isn't too grandiose a word, and what is left. And essentially, either because I'm rather tired these days or I've been losing a lot of cases these days or whatever it was, I don't think so. I think it's because I felt this way for a while. Some of the perhaps pessimism that is warranted by the tasks of making any meaningful change in what must surely be one of the most bankrupt social institutions ever devised by the mind of man, the American prison system. Now, the business of repression and injustice, they've always really been a part of almost every human society, but American society is a little bit different in the sense that it's one of the few societies that was explicitly founded on a faith and a hope in the ability of a society dedicated to liberty to survive. Lincoln said it in his Gettysburg Address, that we're still wondering, and we still are wondering, certainly after the Watergate revelations and the kinds of things that nearly, well, that did happen and nearly happened, whether a free society can survive. And one of the most difficult parts of that free society is that how it deals with situations where it takes away freedom, when it explicitly says the guarantees of the Constitution about life, liberty, and property don't apply to you. One area where that was true quite explicitly was with respect to slavery. And this country has never yet come to terms fully with the problems created by that. One of the other areas where we have not come to terms with it was the prison system, which was really created around 1820 or 1830 in a fearful but apparently hopeful belief that prisoners could be rehabilitated by taking them out of bad environments, removing them from the place where they had been brought up horribly, putting them in an antiseptic environment, and hopefully they would be reformed. David Rothman has analyzed this in a really brilliant book called The Discovery of the Asylum, indicating how prisons and workhouses and mental institutions all developed during the same period, during a period of great fear that American society was falling apart, the Jacksonian period, and yet still great hope with the frontiers and all that vast country out there. And the problem was that it became very clear very quickly that although somehow the prison system had taken very deep root, it wouldn't work. And the terrible abuses that we all know, that I assume Tom Merton talked about his, when he probably discussed his experiences at Arkansas, that John Bach talked about, that the two ex-prisoners who were here, whom I don't know, talked about, they go way, way back to 1830 and 1840, shortly after the prison system was formed. And the essence of it is that the prisoner was not treated with respect, not treated as a human being. And that's really what this whole ball game is about, what this whole prison problem is all about. Now, as I say, I'm a lawyer and I deal with rights. I deal with liberties. And to some extent, maybe I overstate the issue, or not so much overstate the issue, but distort the issue to put it into my terms. But for those of you who have any sense of philosophy at all, or who have had any philosophy, much of the essence of democratic theory really comes from the Kantian moral imperative about treat every person as an end in himself or herself and not as a means only. And to treat people as ends in themselves, you've got to accept the fact that they have certain inalienable rights, certain rights as human beings. And this is the uniqueness of this country, that those rights, unlike most countries, were at the very foundation point of this nation in the Constitution and its Bill of Rights and earlier in the Declaration in 1776. Even though as early as 1776, insofar as blacks were concerned, a draft of the Declaration of Independence said something about it, and then they were eliminated from it. Now, the notion of rights is one that has for years been alien in the prison setting. Back in the 1880s, a Virginia judge said, "A prisoner has no more rights than a slave." We don't talk that way anymore. We talk the exact opposite now. We say that prisoners have all the rights of free people, except those that are necessary for penological purposes of security, rehabilitation, isolation, and such. But that's not the reality. The fact is that prison administrators, many judges, many people feel that prisoners have no rights, only privileges, which are subject to withdrawal at any time. Certain things everybody seem agreed upon, but when the chips are down, when it comes to enforcing these rights, up to about 10 years ago, less, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, mid-60s, 1966, 67, 65, courts and other people who might have some power took what came to be called the hands-off attitude. Hands-off prisons, we won't bother with them. If you asked a federal court to mix in and you were complaining about a state prison, the federal court would say, not only do we not mix into prisons, but we especially don't mix into state prisons. That's not our affair. And so though the verbal talk about prisoners have no more rights than slaves was repudiated, the reality remained the same. Now, it's therefore no secret that the terrible abuses that I'm sure you have heard about, read about, heard about this week quite explicitly, grew up. Because if there's one thing we can be sure of, it's that if some people are put under the absolute and invisible control of other people, there will be terrible abuses. Visibility and absolutism are the twin evils that are involved here. Now, let me just take a minute to perhaps belabor the obvious with you, but let me talk for a few minutes about the two reasons for prison explosions and why prison is such a ghastly place. A prison essentially is a small place. It's a small city that's a total society. And it's a place where people don't want to be. There's no freedom of movement, obviously. There's no sex, except homosexual and often forcible. And often the homosexual sex that's there has very little to do with sex. It has a lot to do with power and aggressiveness. The work is meaningless. The food is dull. There's nothing to do. And all of those things that make life worth living, love, companionship, work, recreation, respect from your peers and from those in some degree whom you look up to or who have some upper position, if you will, none of those are present. In addition, there are all kinds of what sociologists call status degradation ceremonies. They used to shave people's heads. People are called by numbers. One of the worst examples of this is that when there were 43 people killed at the Attica Rebellion, something like 11 or 9, I've forgotten which, civilians and guards, and 39 or whatever it was, 29 inmates. The guards were treated, of course, like people, like dead people, with great deference. But the families of the inmates got curt telegrams telling them so-and-so number, such-and-such, is deceased. If you want the body, please call. And nothing more. That's an example of the kind of callous bureaucratic indifference that develops. And a lot of this gets focused on the guard. And the guard is, in some ways, one of the worst victims of this barbarous and bankrupt social institution. Because guards are men who are trying to make a living at a rotten job. For many of them, it's one of two jobs, and sometimes, as was true at Attica, it's the moonlighting job. They really want to do something else. There's no self-esteem involved. The community sees this, the prison guard, I mean, my God, it's about as low as you can get on the status ladder and still be considered a member of the working community. And he's scared. He's outnumbered anywhere from 20 to 100 to 1. And he doesn't really know what's happening there. He knows he has to get along with these people. He gets orders from above. He doesn't have much education. He doesn't have much training, certainly, for this frightfully difficult job. And so what you have, essentially, is a warehousing job. He becomes a warehouseman of human flesh. And nobody likes to think of himself as that. And he's scared. And the prison authorities recognize this. And so they realize that there is a tinderbox there. And their primary concern becomes security. And once security becomes the primary concern, there is no hope whatsoever for any kind of civility, any kind of freedom, any kind of liberty whatsoever. Because security is a bottomless well. There's never enough of it, and like a tennis ball can that's vacuum-packed, the minute there's the slightest hole in it, it's gone in the eyes of the administrators. And so there's nothing that administrators don't consider relevant to security. And it becomes truly a totalitarian state in which they try to reach even into the minds of the inmates to control them. I know of cases where letters were stopped because they ended with power to the people. A client of mine wrote in a private diary, which he did not circulate, and which he had been told he could keep, that the warden was a cigar-smoking SOB, a cigar-chomping SOB, and that the fellow, the deputy commissioner who had turned him down for parole, was a creep. He lost 60 days good time and was put in segregation for 60 days. There is no limit to this kind of thing, and that's the way our prisons were run. And then on top of it, you had the constant friction between the guards and the inmates. Because since the inmates clearly didn't want to be there, they were not manageable. That's the phrase that's used. They were not manageable. And they would talk back, and they would act up. I had one client who had been at Attica for 18 years. He had gone in at the age of 18 on a murder charge. And I said to him, how do you get along here? And he says, not bad, but every so often I break the rules. And I said, well, what do you mean every so often you break the rules? Is there any particular reason? He said, oh yeah, you got to break the rules to make them remember that you're a man and that they're not winning completely over you. And obviously those kinds of attitudes produce frictions, they produce fear, they produce insecurity on both sides. And there is a symbiotic relationship here of hate and fear and loathing and all those other things that make this an impossible society. And it becomes the perfect paradigm of a police state, because all that the keepers think about is security. And that's what police is all about, law and order. And that's all they think about, and they want to control everything. And so you have one element of the tinderbox. And that's what prison is all about, really, to start with. Rehabilitation is nonsense. It's a fraud, at best a delusion, and at worst a fraud. We, for one thing, we don't know how to change people, if that's what we're talking about, change people's minds. It's hard enough to do, if you were thinking of doing psychotherapy, it's hard enough to do that with people on the outside successfully, much less with people on the inside. Secondly, we don't want to do it. We don't spend money on that kind of stuff. I've forgotten what the figures are, but it's something like 90% is devoted to of the prison budget is devoted to custody and 10% to treatment. The educational and literacy programs and work programs, which might do some good, they're not taken seriously. We don't spend money on that. It's difficult to get people to go there, out to prisons. And so the educational programs are usually garbage, although in some places high school equivalency programs aren't too bad. And that's what prison's all about. It's punishment, pure and simple, and we ought to recognize that. And talk about rehabilitation is pernicious, because we do terrible things to people in the name of rehabilitation. In my state, in New York, I don't know if this is true in Minnesota, but in my state, New York, we send kids away for 4 years for committing petty offenses if they're between 16 and 21 in the name of rehabilitation, when if they were over 21, they might only get 90 days. We send sexual psychopaths away for sentences of a day to life. Sexual psychopath is often a guy who does nothing more than unzip his pants in front of little girls. And he may be sent away for life, theoretically for rehabilitation, but actually for nothing. There is no rehabilitation, and friends of mine have gotten clients released on the ground that no rehabilitation was shown. We currently have a lawsuit against the statute which keeps kids in for 4 years because they've committed a misdemeanor in the name of rehabilitation. And no rehabilitation takes place. If it does, it's an accident. It's despite the system rather than because of it. Now, this is the normal situation. This is the situation which makes the prison an inherently volatile and unviable institution and has produced prison riots for many, many years. As those of you who saw the Attica movie will know, Attica itself was built in 1931 in a response to a wave of prison riots in New York in the 1920s. Indeed, in the Attica riot in 1971 was really the sequel to a prior uprising at Auburn in November 1970, where the prison institution, the prison administration rather, double-crossed the inmates who had taken hostages. The prison administration had promised that there would be no reprisals, and there were brutal reprisals, which New York Commissioner Oswald himself admitted, but claimed correctly that he had not been the commissioner at the time this had happened. That's one of the major factors in the Attica uprising, which until the McKay Commission report and this movie came out, has really been ignored in most of the discussion. But that's endemic to all prisons, everywhere. Now we have a very different item into this terribly volatile mix, and that's blackness. Because the prison now is largely a black institution. I don't know if this is so true in Minnesota, but it is certainly true in places like California, New York, Massachusetts, the great cities and states of the Northeast. And one has to see prison particularly in the black experience. For most white people, particularly middle-class white people, prison is a metaphor, one of the basic metaphors of society, but essentially something that comes across very rarely. Recent experience with Mr. Agnew indicates how rare it is, even when you've been caught with your hand deep down into the till, and a very deep till at that. Agnew did not go to prison, and a lot of other people in Agnew's position don't go to prison. Embezzlers, for example, rarely go to prison, and a lot of other white-collar criminals don't go to prison, but black people go to prison. They go to jails, awaiting trial, sometimes even when they're innocent, and then they're acquitted, and they go to prisons. And at Attica, 55% of the population was black, and another 10% was Latin. And in the black experience, prison is central. A story on the Attica uprising reported that that L.D. Barclay, whom some of you may recall, although most of you probably don't, was the fiery orator with granny glasses who was killed in the takeover on September 13th, came from a ward in Rochester where the parents spoke of the prisons to which their children were sent, the way middle-class people speak of the colleges to which their children are sent. It is the one of the, how to put it, one of the key points in the criminal justice system which beats on black people, starting with the black kid on the street who's told to move along by the white cop in Harlem and Los Angeles and in places like that, and then through the family courts and ultimately into prison, and then out and back in, and then out and back in. It is central to the black experience. And in a way, all of those things that happen on the outside to black people, police repression, no work, arbitrary discipline, arbitrary criminal law system, bad medical care, all of those things that are so much a feature of the dark side of American society are concentrated in the prison. They are concentrated as if in a pressure cooker. And the kinds of explosions that have taken place, and the kinds of both psychological and physical, and the kinds of militancy and rising up angry that have taken place outside are taking place inside. And this has compounded the problem for prison administrators and keepers many, many fold. Because what you have in the prison is not only the outside society compressed in the pressure cooker, but a concentration on one aspect of that outside society, and in many ways the most dangerous. That is the police street confrontation. Because as I indicated a few minutes ago, a prison is a police state. There is virtually nothing else in a prison except police, the guards. At Attica, and in most prison institutions, the inmates refer to the guards as police. The guards walk around wearing not guns in New York, but billy clubs, which they call nigger sticks, blue uniforms like the police. They have police insignia, captains, bars, lieutenants, the whole paramilitary deal. They wear things that look like police caps, and indeed, they look very much like policemen. And there's a real solidarity between police and prison guards. The Buffalo Police Department held a special memorial service for the Attica guards who were killed. This is recognized as solidarity. And what you have, therefore, in prison, and you have it worse in many, many ways, is you have generally the white guard who, unlike the city policeman, who sometimes is black and sometimes knows the people he's dealing with, generally you have rural white prison guards who have no contact with blacks whatsoever, often come from the most conservative parts of the community, facing militant black men in what is a permanent police-black confrontation. And given that, how can one be at all surprised that we have had a series of bloody prison uprisings? Because Attica is not the first of the recent ones. At Pendleton in Indiana in 1969, three or four blacks and other prisoners were killed. In Rayford Prison in Florida, you had shooting by either state police or guards into a mass of prisoners who were in uprising. You've had this over and over again throughout the country. Now the newspapers have kind of toned down, but if you read the back pages of any of the big newspapers, you will see over and over again references to prison uprisings. McAllister in Oklahoma, Arizona, the numbers just goes on and on. It doesn't stop because the conditions which create it are so much a part. They're not a small conspiracy. It's not a few outside agitators. It's not a bunch of lawyers or movement people. It's a rotten, bankrupt social institution which is grinding people down, and some of the people don't want to take it anymore. Now that paints a pretty bleak picture, and I think it's largely true. It's not intended to indicate that if you change the color of the guards, that will change the problem. It'll help a little bit, but you still have the reality of prison. And I think that's what we're faced with. Now, in this kind of setting, where does the picture, what is the role of rights? Because what a right is, it's a sort of, as in the American Revolution, a don't tread on me. It's a shield which says to authority, you can go thus far and no farther. This is mine. You cannot pierce this. You can't get by it. How does that fit in the total institution of a prison? Well, there have been some developments, and I think they've been substantial, but they've been very limited. And they're even more limited than they seem. And I'd like to take just a few minutes with you to run down some of the areas in which there have been changes, or at least court decisions establishing rights. It seems pretty clear now that beatings and that kind of terrible abuse, holes, cells, such were existed in New York, where there was no light burning, where the window was broken out, where a man was kept with a bucket and nothing more, naked, and the temperatures fell to 20 below zero. This is all in court records. In California, the hot box, where in 100 degree heat in a metal cell, a man is left with nothing to drink and nobody to talk to. Solitary confinement that continues for days and months and even years so that people go crazy. A lot of that has been condemned by courts and indeed may have been eliminated in a lot of places. There is a right to decent medical care, but it's a right that's more honored in the breach, because the truth is we don't have the resources to provide decent medical care for our society even on the outside, but at least it's been established, for whatever that's worth. We have won a great many cases on discipline, which require that before somebody is disciplined by being put in segregation or losing key privileges or losing good time so that he has to serve longer than he might have, he's entitled to some kind of hearing where he can know the case against him and respond to it and give an explanation. That never used to be true before. I was involved in one case where a man was asked whether he was involved in a prison. He was told, you're charged with having been involved in some kind of prison disturbance. And he said, I plead not guilty. And the prison warden said, okay, 18 months in the box. He said, now wait a minute. And the warden said to him, what do you mean, wait a minute? Didn't you say you pled not guilty? And he said, yeah. He said, that's right. Okay, send him away 18 months in the box. And that was the whole hearing. That's been changed. We forced changes there. We have managed to, and I'm talking primarily about lawyers, and this is what, these are essentially court decisions. There have been other vehicles of change, but I'm talking about those at the moment. We have managed to deal with the problem of censorship a little bit. I had a client who wrote a letter to his girlfriend. In this letter, he asked her to get him a lawyer in connection with something. And he said to her, I am now in Attica concentration camp. The warden sent it back with a note at the top, this letter cannot go out because the name of this place is Attica Correction Facility. Another fellow wrote a letter to his family and said, this place stinks. I think those were the exact words. The letter wouldn't go out. In New York, on top of every form that prisoners had to use to write, it said, you may not write about the following 10 categories. One of them, no prison news, no reference to another prison inmate, no begging. Guy wants to write home and ask them to send him some money, that won't go. If he wants to tell them he's in trouble in prison, that's prison news. Clearly no criticism of the prison. That kind of stuff, if we can catch it, I think is stopped. In some jurisdictions, we have managed to ensure that prisoners can write confidential, unopened letters to their lawyers. Never used to be true. In some jurisdictions, we have won the right of press access so that the press can go in and interview prisoners whom they want to see. Prisoners can write letters to the press. These things didn't used to be true. Reading matter. In New York, nothing about psychology, because prisons are convinced that rape, masturbation, and everything else take place by osmosis. So that if somebody reads about something, it'll happen, and all hell will break loose. And so anything to do with any Freud, anything at all to do with psychology, was excluded. That's not true anymore. Anything militant whatsoever was excluded. That's not true anymore. Out of a list of some 70 items that we were given about a year ago by New York State in a lawsuit that we brought against them to challenge their exclusion of literature, they folded even before we went to trial, which we're now in the process of doing, on 60 of them. Elijah Speaks, practically all issues of the Black Panther Party newspaper, the Black Scholar, a lot of underground press gets in without too much trouble in a lot of places. See what else. Racial discrimination, it's been barred in theory. In practice, it still exists, I'm sure, but it's been barred. The parole system, I must say that this is the thing I feel most bitter about, believe it or not, because I consider that the parole system is the most hypocritical aspect of the whole business. Parole is a method of control, really not much more. It is a way to keep somebody under the control of the police when the man gets out on a parole, and it is a way to control people while in prison by dangling over their heads the prospect that they will lose parole if they don't behave. And rehabilitation counseling, that's all nonsense. Most parole officers work hand in glove with the police. In New York, which is the worst state in the union, we impose some 32 parole conditions on parolees, including 11 o'clock curfews on 25-year-old men. They have to turn in their driver's license. They can't live with a woman, not their wives. They can't leave their community, and until recently, they wouldn't be told what their community was. When you ask, they simply say, he knows, without permission. All of these things, which are explicitly stated by the parole board to be things which cannot possibly be adhered to, are imposed. Why? Because if they don't like him, or if they suspect him of something that they can't prove, or her, because on women the parole system is particularly brutal. Women parole officers tend to be particularly moralistic and punitive. And if they've got something that they can't prove, they can always take one of these technical violations. And a huge number of people have their parole revoked because they were driving without a license, because they stayed out late, because they associated with people they had met in prison. I had a girl who was in on a wayward minor charge, a 17-year-old kid. Wayward minor in this case meant nothing more than that she and her mother couldn't get along, and she stayed out at night, and her mother had her committed. And this is, I was involved in striking down the statute. Mother had her committed, and it's a 3-year sentence to, because there's only one institution for women in New York State, a prison. This girl didn't want to be there, and she was a very spirited girl. So instead of getting out at 9 months on parole, they kept her there for 14 months, a 17-year-old girl, with all kinds of people with hardened and difficult criminal records. So she gets out. Her mother, by this time, among other things, had had a change of heart. She gets out, and they contact, somehow I got involved with it, I don't remember how. And then a month later, I hear that her parole was about to be revoked. And what are the charges? She had lunch with a girl she met in the institution. She was caught trying to mail a letter to a girl she'd met in Syracuse, from Syracuse in the institution. And she was staying out at night again, staying with, I think, her cousin. The real reason was that she and her mother weren't getting along again. And they were ready to bust her and send her back to prison. Until we came in and we figured out some legal theory where, when we told the judge, he said to us, look, you just figure out any old theory, and if it's at all plausible, I'm not going to let them send this girl back. But the parole board was ready to send her back. these holds that they have on people. And we've made some changes there. They used to be able to revoke parole just on a parole officer's say-so. Now, because of a Supreme Court decision, they have to have some kind of hearing. So we've made some progress. But the truth is that we're really on the very, very first steps of a very, very long journey. And even these steps of progress that we've made really don't amount to a hell of a lot, because they can be evaded so easily, and we have so little resources. For example, let's take the business of discipline of people for violations of some prison rule. These occur in the hundreds and thousands each year. They involve generally the word of a guard except that against that of an inmate. In the free world, the word of a cop against a person presumptively innocent always prevails. It'll obviously continue that way in the prison system. There won't be any impartial tribunal. Most judges in most of these cases on the criminal side, in the criminal courts, are biased toward the police and the prosecution, even though they're technically not members of the law enforcement branch anymore. They're a third branch of government. But in prison, the tribunal is invariably a member of the prison staff. Is he going to find against the prisoner, against the guard, and say the guard is lying and believe the prisoner? I mean, that's just nonsense. So what are we doing in these cases? Well, to some extent, we're gumming up the system. We're making it somewhat more difficult. And in the hard cases where they really slam somebody hard, we may be making it possible from some lawyer somewhere, if one can find them. And that's another problem. There just aren't enough lawyers to go around to do something to avoid this kind of thing. The prison and mail censorship, the mail censorship business, well, that should be very easy. And indeed, an awful lot of prison administrations on their own have abandoned censorship. But that's very hard to monitor. I'm constantly being told that my mail to people is being read even though there's a rule against it. I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And so I'm very scared about sending confidential stuff in letters to them. Book and reading matter censorship, that I think we can make stick. Because although they do hassle us and hold up books sometimes for 5 or 6 or 8 weeks before they let the inmate have it, by and large, they've let a lot through. Parole, well, we've managed to set up some procedural safeguards, but there isn't a bureaucracy in the world that can't roll with the punch and smother procedural safeguards and ultimately learn to ignore them. Because the truth is, with most procedural safeguards, if we're lucky, and I'm not sure some of you will understand this illusion, but if we're lucky, we'll raise them to the level of the lowest criminal courts in our country. And the lowest criminal courts in our countries are scandalous in the lack of decent treatment and fairness and in racism and discrimination. On the issue of racism, on such important things as job assignment, parole, and the like, we can't prove that. It's very, very difficult to prove. And so it goes. A lot of these things are very, very feeble protections. So what's it all about? Why do we continue? Well, we continue because this is one way of making some progress. And there are certain things which can be done with some significance. Ultimately, we must abolish the prison system as we have it today. Otherwise, we will simply continue this social obscenity, this institutional disgrace. But that's a prison, by definition, is a totalitarian society, as I've said. And the notion of individual rights and the reality of a totalitarian society are an irreconcilable conflict, because by definition, totalitarian means total. There is nothing impervious. There are no don't tread on me kinds of things there. There are no shields. It reaches into the thoughts. And of course, that's the 1984 society. That's what prison is all about, 1984 right now. Big brother in your thoughts. Now, therefore, the only real solution is to abolish the prison as we know it today. Doesn't mean we abolish all prisons. It doesn't mean we abolish prison for everybody in all kinds of prisons. There are some people at Attica and elsewhere whom I don't want walking the streets. I don't really like to get cut up. I don't like to get assaulted. I don't like to get murdered, and I don't like women to get raped. There are dangerous people, but they're a fraction. They're a very, very small fraction of the people who are in prisons. And if we had prisons solely for those people, they might very well be different kinds of institutions, provided that they were very visible and that they were watched very carefully and that we had other things going along with it that I'm not even sure of at the moment, because it may be that all we might wind up with, and I'm not at all sure that this wouldn't happen, is smaller scale versions of what we have now. For most other people, they don't have to be in prison. Somebody was saying to me the other day that our prison system is the most irrational thing in the world from a pure dollars and cents basis. It costs a fortune. We support people. We give people free room and board. It's not very good, but in many ways, the food is healthier than the food that people eat on the outside. It's dull, it's monotonous, it's dreary, but it's probably healthier, and it's there. There are three meals a day. And one stays out of the rain and out of the cold. And for many people, after a while, they become so institutionalized that they can't live in the free world. And of course, that's what prison is all about. Because the ultimate irrationality in prison, which is what I meant to say before, is that it trains people for living in the free world by treating them in the most repressive way imaginable. It cuts out, it represses, it stamps out the slightest sign of responsibility and independence for purposes of security. And so people can't learn to live in the outside world. One of my clients was released from prison after a year and a half or 2 years, and he was brought to my office from Attica. And he came in, and I said to him, Richard — this is Richard X. Clark, one of the men involved in Attica — I said, I'm delighted to see you. It's 11:30 or 12 o'clock. Why don't we have some lunch? And I don't think it's a good idea for us to go out to a restaurant, because you might be known in this area, and I don't think you want that yet. Let's order some sandwiches up to my office. What would you like? And he looked at me and said, what would I like? I'm not used to that kind of question, what would I like? And I said, well, you can have this, that. And I could see there was a real culture shock going on. And then he picked up the phone and wanted to make a lot of calls. And I said, sure. You can't do that. Those fundamental, basic things, I mean, about the only thing you can do in prison is light a cigarette when you feel like it, but not much else. And that's why we've got to, in Joan Baez's phrase in one of her songs, raise the prisons to the ground. Unfortunately, it's going the other way. Most LEAA corrections money is going to building more institutions. But for those people who don't go to prison, we can do a lot of things. We can provide them with certain kinds of jobs for which we have no people today, such as workers in hospitals, counselors, working with people in trouble, service things which this society is desperately in need of, pay them a decent wage, and charge them for restitution or fines or something like that. We can have weekend prison. We can have night prison. We can have all kinds of variations on this kind of thing. Many of these people are no dangers to society, and insofar as some of them are dangers to our property, like shoplifters and forgers and the like, the truth is that much of that is covered by insurance anyway. And the society can tolerate it. Every society must endure always a certain amount of crime. And there's very little that our social institutions, like prisons and the criminal justice system and the police, can do about it, because crime grows out of fundamental social conditions, such as a baby boom. Crime is largely a phenomenon of 15 to 25-year-olds. When there was a baby boom after the war, we knew there'd be a crime wave. And now that's slackened down. And so we know and we can see that there has been a slight decline in crime rates. So where do the lawyers come in? And where do the notions of rights come in? Well, lawyers, at least the lawyers I know, don't have any illusions about how much we can accomplish. The civil rights movement taught us how indispensable we are, and yet how terribly, terribly limited we are. We can prod, we can shake up the system, We can open some doors, we can loosen things up, but the real changes are sort of fundamental, organic changes in the society. And so, as I see it, our primary concern is to facilitate those changes rather than expect to do it all ourselves. No group can do it all ourselves, particularly not lawyers, and particularly not outsiders. The only groups that have any hopes, the only group that has any hopes of doing a major part of it are the prisoners themselves. Because one thing we've learned from the various liberation movements, the gay movement, the women's movement, the black movement, is that only those who are suffering are the ones who can really make the changes, who will be there over and over again to insist that the changes be made. I'm a white middle-class lawyer. I teach school and I practice law, civil rights law, and so on. I visit a prison and I take down notes and I make certain promises about what I'm going to do, and then I go home to my family and I teach my class. When the summer comes, I like to go away for a few weeks to Cape Cod. As I grow older, I guess I'll be more and more tired and wearier and more discouraged and more depressed at these things. And sooner or later, I will either die or just fade away or just turn to other things. That's true of all of us on the outside, but the prisoners, they're still there. So we've got to figure out ways to make them more powerful, because the essence of humanity is treatment, is respect. It comes back to that I said before, respect for other people. And truthfully, the way the world goes, we don't respect other people who have no power, who have no way of implementing their desires. And so those of us who are in the prison rights movement have been working to do a couple of things, what we call roughly First Amendment kinds of things. First, to keep those places visible, to keep the press moving in and out, to make it possible so that they don't get shut off again and be put far away, not only geographically, but emotionally and psychologically and socially. Keep correspondence lines, visiting lines open so that the contact can continue and the people on the inside can continually feel supported by people on the outside. I have brought lawsuits that I knew I was going to lose. I was involved in a lawsuit involving John Bach that we knew we were going to lose. Why? Because the lawsuit came up in the aftermath of an emergency, an outbreak, an uprising, or something like that. And very often, and no judge wants to help the prisoner there. His sympathies and concerns are all for the prison administrator. But we brought those lawsuits knowing we would lose, because we knew that the inmates wanted us to bring those suits, wanted to feel that there's somebody working for them and who will bring them to the community, into a courtroom, to speak to the community at large. We're trying to develop and help develop prisoners' unions and prisoners associating with each other. A very, very difficult task, because just as in the labor management field, a union means power to the workers. And management, whether it's industrial management or prison management, fears that more than anything else. It's part of the security bit in prison. And so those are the kinds of things we're trying to develop. On the other side, we're trying to end prison, to get prisons abolished, not so much attacking the whole prison system, but for individuals or groups. We're trying to keep people out on parole, trying to make sure that the parole authorities don't pull people back easily or lightly, and hopefully not at all. We're trying to strike at sentencing practices, which send people away, as I said, for 4 years. We're trying to strike at those things which enable them to take away good time for nothing. In other words, we're concentrating very heavily on getting people out and keeping them out, insofar as the correctional system is concerned. Those are our twin areas of focus. Having said all this, again, the prognosis is not good. But we really have no choice. Prisons are one of the classic illustrations of the trite phrase, but unfortunately one that seems always appropriate, man's inhumanity to man. And we just don't have any choice. We've got to keep trying to do something to end that abomination. Where we've had some successes, but as I've said, they're really very early steps on a long, long road. And as in Vietnam, the light at the end of the tunnel, it's not in sight, and as it was not then when people said it was. But we've got to keep trying. There are lots of things that can be done, both to make those institutions a bit more humane. I don't agree with those people who say that we should ignore the cry for simply making those places a little more humane because we thereby legitimate the system and make those places more tolerable. For one thing, we'll never make those places tolerable, so that you don't have to worry about. I don't think we legitimate them, and frankly, when somebody is crying out to me in a letter that they're doing this to me, they're brutalizing me, they're doing that to me, they're denying me medical care, if I think I can do something, and I don't often think I can, or if they're trying to take me back and revoke my parole unjustly, I'm not going to wait for the millennium when the prisons are razed to the ground. We're going to try to help whatever we can now.